You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Hey guys, you're watching the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all across the country. And as you're growing your practice, there are three critical agreements that you're going to want to know the difference between. One of them being the independent contractor agreement, the employment agreement, and a partnership agreement. And I've got one of dentistry's best experts today to help us understand the difference between the three and what you're going to want to know about them. David Cohen. So do not miss this. So do me a favor, grab a pen and hit the share button. We'll see you in a few seconds.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Barrett is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you're looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Best Practice Show. Thank you so much for watching and thank you so much for your requests and things that you want to see. We're doing our best to get all of them on the show. And today is no exception. I got a good friend of mine, actually one of my attorneys that helped me organize all of my agreements and things like that, David Cohen on. We're going to be talking about these three critical agreements and what you need to know about them, because there's a lot going on, especially towards the end of the year, that you're going to want to know about each one of these. Now, before we get started, a couple show notes. We are shooting this live on Facebook. So if you have questions, feel free to add the questions to the feed and I'll ask David directly and we'll get the answers straight from him. Also, if you're watching these later on, which a lot of people are, continue to add your questions and we'll have David get back to you and get you the answers that you're looking for, because we want you to get the most out of these. Now, my guest today, he's been on before, but a lot of our friends, a lot of our colleagues, a lot of our clients use you, and you and I have gotten a chance to know each other through the Seattle Study Club, you know, entire network, which has been amazing. And so, David, if people don't know who you are, just tell us a little bit about who you are, kind of your background and what you do right now.
So I'm an attorney that specializes in helping dentists from a business law perspective. I get a lot of calls about malpractice claims and such, but really what I focus on is the business side of dentistry. And so that typically entails the drafting and reviewing of associate documentation, partnership documentation, buy, purchase and sell documentation, and real estate related documentation in connection with the dental practices. Own a law firm that specializes in these realms and work with clients all over the country to help them achieve their goals as far as their transactions are concerned.
Mm-hmm. You are truly one of the hardest working men in all of dentistry. I don't know when you sleep. I hope you sleep.
Thank you. Following your footsteps.
No. It's good stuff. Now, these three agreements, this is very timely too, because these three agreements are popping up a lot towards the end of the year. There's a lot of pressure being felt that people have to get things done legally in a calendar year. And before we get into them, let's just talk about why it's important to understand the difference in these three, David, from your perspective.
So as you mentioned, as the end of the year approaches, everybody wants to get deals done. And deals typically consist of purchases and sales, partnerships, and associateships, whether it's somebody wanting to bring associates into their practice or whether it's somebody selling their practice and then working back as an associate. Either way, the associate agreement comes into place. And so to distinguish between the three, obviously the associate agreement is for post-deal for someone who's selling or getting into the deal for someone who's becoming an associate in a practice and then may buy in the future. The partnership agreement would be if the associate actually buys into the practice or somebody else buys into a practice or people merge into a practice. And the purchase agreement is what helps people get into the deal if they're going to either buy a practice outright or buy into a partnership. What's important is to distinguish in the associate realm between the employment agreement and the independent contractor agreement. And I think there are a lot of questions about that for my clients as they embark on their deals, trying to close here and make a push toward the end of the year. And so that's one of the things I want to talk to you about today was to distinguish between the two, independent contractor and employment agreement, and then touch on some things in connection with partnership agreements that I'm seeing more recently as these end of the year deals close, as well as the purchase agreements.
Absolutely. Now, this is necessarily for every young dentist, but one of the things that you and I both see are young dentists obviously feeling a lot of the pressure financially coming out of dental school. And so they're quick to make decisions oftentimes and understanding that partnerships aren't the only agreement. Like there are other options here that you can kind of settle in. And you and I were talking before we went live, a lot of the problems that you see or that we see that we can fix, a lot of them can be fixed if we just slow down, do the due diligence before jumping into this so quickly, because once this concrete starts to dry, it can be hard to switch directions, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. As these end of year deals close, it's really important to stay the course and to do what is proper and to take into account a closing date, but try not to push beyond doing things properly. Because as you said, doing something improperly can set you back years, not just days it can be years. And so it's really important to do things right. Perfect example is I just got on my desk a big partnership deal a couple of days ago, and the doctors wanted to sign the agreements the next day. And so I had to tell the client, look, if the documents look perfectly great, I will push to get these reviewed by tomorrow. But if they look great, there's a possibility. But otherwise, this may take some more time. And it's pretty rare that documents don't have some things involved for negotiation. So I knew in my mind it would probably take a little bit longer, but certainly wanted to do the best job that I can do. And it was really important for me to impress upon my client that it's more important to do things properly than to close something that you don't even know what's going on. And so we reviewed the documents and we're still in that process now, actually. They did not end up signing the next day, but people do. And they make mistakes and they get rushed into things by all the parties involved in the deal. Sellers want to sell, brokers want to broker, banks want to fund. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everyone has a job to do. But we can't control other parties. We can only control ourselves. And so I try to impress upon my clients to stay the course and do what's proper on your end. And if you're doing it in a reasonable period of time and something doesn't work out, then it probably wasn't meant to be because you did everything you can do on your end. And that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's jump into the first two and give us some critical key pieces to understand about independent contractor versus employment agreements. What do we need to know about these two?
Yeah, one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make in deals and in viewing hundreds of these, and it's important to think about this as the year closes, because many of you out there may end up seeing these agreements in your transaction, is the employment agreement, the independent contractor agreement, is to know that one of the biggest mistakes is choosing the wrong agreement. And when I say choosing the wrong agreement, what I mean is the law is going to dictate which route you can go. And so oftentimes doctors will choose one agreement over the other just because that's what they prefer, that's what they feel like, or that's what they heard somewhere, is, or maybe their buddy did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And really, that's not the way to approach it. You should consult your team, your advisors, and ask them about what the proper route is for you based upon what the law says and based upon what you are looking to accomplish in the deal. And so to elaborate further on that, the independent contractor agreement should be viewed as a very hands-off type of agreement. And what I mean by that is, think about somebody that you hire to mow your lawn at your house. Well, they bring their own equipment and they already know what to do, their expertise. You're not giving them direction or telling them what to do. And they come and they bring their equipment and they mow your lawn and they do their job and you pay them for that job. And then they go to your next door neighbor and they mow their lawn as well, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the true essence of an independent contractor, because there are no elements of control. And what the IRS and state departments of revenue look at when they are auditing practices to determine whether they are independent contractors or really employees are elements of control. And so when you look at a dental practice and you look at a practice that is providing all the staff and the facilities and the equipment, and many doctors out there want to provide direction and control how the associate will perform certain duties under the contract, those are all elements of control. Furthermore, providing benefits such as health insurance or liability insurance, CE stipends, those are all elements of control. Those are ways to control the associate. That scenario would be an employment scenario. And I often see doctors whip out independent contractor agreements for their associates because they want to save them on employment taxes. And they know that if they make their doctor an independent contractor, they save on employment taxes, but yet they're still trying to provide health insurance, or they're providing control and direction over all the dynamics under the agreement. That would be a violation. Now, I think the biggest poison out there is the fact that not every practice gets audited. Mm-hmm. And so many doctors operate this way without a problem because nobody ever investigates into their situation. Right. The problem is, if the situation does get investigated, a practice can be nailed pretty badly for back taxes and penalties. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to understand the elements of what make a doctor a contractor versus an employee, and understand what level of risk that doctor wants to take on. I typically don't recommend that they take on that risk. And I am recommending more and more now that if there's even a question, that the associate be an employee, because more and more practices are being audited for this. And when there is an audit, often auditors want to substantiate their audit, and so they will find something. I just had a practice in Wisconsin, actually, that was audited, and it really was a true independent contractor dynamic. It was a general dentistry practice, and ortho was coming in to do the work. They brought their own staff, they brought their own equipment. There was really no directions or elements of control there. And the Department of Revenue had to do something, so they nailed the doctor for minimal penalties. I mean, it really was nothing major. It was just dinging them here or there just to kind of substantiate them being there. So it's tough to get out completely clean. But, you know, the doctor did come out pretty clean under the circumstances, but many others are not as lucky. And so it's really important to understand that, and also know that the contract itself is not the biggest governing factor. The contract is there to follow, but the actions are the most important. So if an auditor comes into your office, you can't just hand them your contract and say, well, see what we have on paper, that's what we do, and therefore this is a true contractor dynamic. They're going to actually look at what was done. Mm-hmm. Because you can put anything you want on paper, but what's actually being done in the practice is what's critical. So they're going to look at the actions, they're going to interview all of the employees, and they're going to really investigate to determine if really you're just trying to cut corners and treat someone who really should be an employee as an independent contractor. And again, it falls back on elements of control.
Yeah. It's so funny you say that, because in our time, we see a lot of people trying to cut corners with taxes and other things like this. And the independent contractor agreement looks very sexy in nature, but it's true. Now, the question I have for you is, how applicable is this? Because in a true independent contractor agreement, this particular individual company or entity has to be able to work in other businesses like yours. And as a dentist, that's probably one of the last things you're going to want in a locality or within close proximity of your office, is having your associate work in other offices that would be right around the corner or up the street.
Yeah, that's a great question. And going back to my example of the person mowing the lawn, like I said, then they probably go to the neighbor's house and they mow their lawn. They go somewhere else. And like you just mentioned, there has to be some level of flexibility and autonomy for that contractor. So number one, it makes exclusivity an issue, which you just touched on. And number two, it also makes non-competes questionable for contractors, because a non-compete is, in a way, it's limiting somebody's ability to work. It's a restraint on trade. It's a limit on someone's ability to make a living. So states don't like that to begin with, let alone someone who is labeled a quote unquote contractor. So you definitely hit on that point. Well, you want to have a contractor and you truly treat them as a contractor and follow what the law says in that regard, you are giving things up. You are relinquishing power. You're relinquishing control, because elements of control are what determine contractor versus employee. And so in order to make the person a contractor, you have to relinquish those elements of control. So there's a give and take. You might benefit from not paying employment taxes, and there are some other benefits as well, but you're also giving something up on the other end of that.
Right. And that might be the perfect runway as you start to entertain a partnership agreement. Am I correct in thinking that way, you know, eventually?
Yeah, it is a good runway, because once someone is established as an associate, whether they're a contractor or whether they're an employee, either way, oftentimes the goal is for that associate to buy into the practice and become a partner. And so it's really important to have a good partnership agreement in place that can govern the operations of the practice moving forward. But I think one step that doctors are failing to take nowadays is to make sure that the partnership is a good fit before they get into that legal documentation process. And one great way to make sure it's a good fit is the associateship and the associate agreement. And that's why we've just touched on that. But unfortunately, deviating a little bit, and I'll circle back on track, but deviating a little bit is there are definitely doctors out there now, and I get calls all the time from people that want to do partnerships and they haven't worked with someone before. They haven't engaged in that associateship dynamic. They haven't even worked with a person at all in any capacity, or maybe they don't even know the person that they may want to partner with. And maybe even worse, they're friends, they're great friends. And that sometimes can be the biggest downfall of a friendship, is getting into a partnership with a friend. And so it's really important that doctors understand that before getting into a partnership, it's really important to lay the foundation to make sure that it's a proper fit. And one great way, like I said, is the associateship route, but doctors aren't always able to do that. They may be out of school and want to partner with their buddy. And so how do they make it successful without ruining a friendship and making a mess and, you know, not being able to get out of loans that they're guaranteeing because they took on a bunch of debt to get into a partnership and it didn't work out, but the bank won't let them out. And it can really be a difficult situation.
Yeah. Now, this is really important. If you're watching this as a dentist, you know, depending on who you listen to, there are experts in dentistry that say between 70 and 90% of all associateships and partnerships fail. I don't know the real statistic on that. You get to see this, but it's pretty high. You see people that go in that are well, they have good intentions, but for some reason it doesn't work out and then it falls apart eventually. But you're a big fan or a big believer, and you can mitigate a lot of this failure with the proper due diligence before jumping into it. And like you mentioned, there's no faster way to kill a friendship than start a business together sometimes. So
to me, I'm not saying these are the two only ways, but the two very effective ways that I see is, number one, the associateship route, which we just talked about, making them an employee or an independent contractor based upon what the law affords. And number two is there is personality testing out there. There are companies that will perform personality testing, and the studies have shown the personality testing to be very accurate. Is it 100% accurate? No, there's no 100% guarantee when you get into a partnership that it will be successful. And doctors, you control your own destiny on that to a large degree. But the studies are very, very accurate for the most part. And they oftentimes will save bad partnerships from happening, and they will affirm that a partnership is likely to succeed. But there's always the outliers. There's always partnerships that personality testing says is going to be great and it doesn't work. And I'm sure that there's partnerships out there where the personality test said things wouldn't work out and the doctor said, screw it, we've been great friends forever, we know this will work, and it worked. But it does help. And again, Kirk, you hit on a great word, which was mitigate. And what you're trying to do is, and nothing in life is certain. So what you want to do is mitigate the possibility of, you know, mitigate the damage, mitigate the possibility of things not working out. And that is associating or at least engaging in some sort of personality testing before you dive in. Because as I mentioned before, not only is it a mess to get out of legal documents in a situation, but you also have debt and loans and bank guarantees that may make it difficult to get out of a partnership. And you also have patients, and you don't want to leave them out to dry, and you need to make sure that the patients are well taken care of. You have a duty by law, but also an ethical obligation to make sure that that end of things doesn't suffer because somebody's in a fight with their partner.
Yeah, absolutely. You should have coffee cups that say, mitigation is cheaper than litigation. Yeah, every relationship, because really the due diligence before, you know, and like you said before, it is a marriage. You know, a lot of times people, they're like, oh, I love my buddy, whatever. If you're watching this and you're married, you know, you got to work at it every day. It's probably one of the most important, it's the most important thing you'll ever do. It's also some of the hardest work that you'll ever do. And now you're going to be married to two, possibly three, maybe five other people. So now you've got your marriage plus five more, which always becomes a challenge. And then also too, the other thing that I always ask people too, that goes beyond the legal piece is, are you a dentist that plays well with other dentists? You know, because there are dentists that say, hey, look, I just like my stuff the way I like it. Don't touch my stuff. And if you're listening to this, you know who you are. And then there are others that are like, hey, look, I don't mind it. I don't mind if it's a little messy back here, whatever. That's part of a business. I'm cool with that. So I think a good piece of this, because once you get into a marriage legally, now you share the decision making. And you know as well as I do, having more than one decision maker is always increasingly complex. At a third one and a fourth one, now you've got other layers of complexity. And man, everybody's got to be synchronized.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone needs to be synchronized. And the parties need to know that you're not going to agree on every single thing, but it's not about the disagreement. Like, the personality testing is not to show that you're going to agree on every single thing. It's to show how are you going to respond to that adversity. And not just the personality testing, you would learn that through an associateship as well. But how do the parties respond to that adversity when there's not an agreement on a matter? And if the personalities are compatible, typically the parties will work to find an equitable and fair resolution that everybody can live with. And even if it's something that not everyone agreed with, there's enough trust and understanding to make that work. So I think that's really the key.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else that we should know about employment agreements before we move into partnership agreements? Because partnership agreements require a lot more thinking and detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is to determine whether the person truly is a contractor or an employee based upon what you envision for the associate, or as an associate, what you envision, and whether that is compatible with what the law says in the state that you're in. And it's always great to consult your team of advisors to help you understand that. It's not something that's easy for somebody who, for instance, isn't well-versed in the law to understand. It doesn't mean that dentists are incredibly smart people. They can understand it if they dig into it, but they got a million other things to do, like practice dentistry. And the last thing they want to do is look at legal statutes or look at the IRS codes. So it's important to engage the legal team or your consultant or, you know, CPAs, depending on what the issue is, to try to determine what position you are in. And from that standpoint, and once you've talked to them, create a plan. So with regard to the contractor thing, let's say you do comply, and it's a very complex, you know, the IRS code will lay out what they'll look at to determine whether someone's a contractor or an employee, but it doesn't say if you do this, they're an employee, and if you do that, they're a contractor. It says, here are all the elements of control that we look at, and we're going to look at the totality of the circumstances to make a determination of whether or not we feel this person really is an employee or a contractor. And so that can be tricky. And so you want to look to someone who has experience, that they've seen what an audit has shown before they, you know, they end up making that determination. So, but once that is determined, whether they're a contractor or an employee, it's important to lay out the material terms of the deal. And if they're a contractor, there certainly can't be elements of control, which would be CE and malpractice and health insurance and things like that. But if they are an employee, then you'll want to discuss with your advisors what the best plan is as far as providing benefits is concerned. And based on your financials and what you can afford, what's the most fair way to proceed so that the associate feels good about it, and so that you feel good about it as far as benefits are concerned. Pay is also obviously important to discuss with your team about, because I get a lot of questions that say, hey, David, I'm a perio in Illinois, and what should I pay my associate? And it goes a lot deeper than that. Sure, there is a realm of what is normal in the industry, but to fluctuate between maybe the bottom end of normal versus the top end of normal will really depend on the situation of the practice, the financials, what the practice can afford, what makes sense. Can the practice even afford an associate at all? Or was it just an idea that went into the doctor's head without really thinking that through? So that's obviously important regarding pay, to talk to your team and make sure that you can A, afford an associate, and if you can, what is fair for you and also going to make the associate feel good about it. Furthermore, I don't think that a practice can always just look at what is quote unquote normal. Some practices are not normal, and some right. practices need to pay an associate based on a different circumstance. So right. That's where your team comes in. And also, you know, non-competes are really important in the associate agreements, mainly because, well, for the practice, it's important to have a non-compete if the state allows it. So number one, you got to make sure that you can have a non-compete in the state that you're in under the circumstance that you're in. And number two, making sure if you can that you have one, if you're the doctor, to preserve the value of your practice, not just to prevent the associate from competing with you, but also preserve the value. Because if somebody wants to buy your practice and you don't have a non-compete with your associate and your associate can open up next door, then the buyer is either going to try to push the price down or not buy the practice at all, because there's a loss of goodwill in the fact that the associate who has gained a lot of goodwill with patients could open up right next door. So the non-compete's critical if your state allows you to have one, not just so that the associate doesn't compete, but also to preserve the value of your practice. So I think that's kind of the main outline of the important points of these associate agreements.
Absolutely. And that's a huge one. Now, I have this question because I get it all the time, and I know it's not scientific, but you're an expert on this. What's your professional opinion on time frame for a young dentist in an employment agreement before being a partner? Like typically, you know, would you say a year, year and a half, 2 years? What's been your opinion?
I think to take one step back before that, it's important to establish a time frame period in any associateship, whether the person's going to be a partner or not. I forgot that element when I was walking through that. So that is important. But yeah, as far as partner is concerned, I'm typically seeing about a year as I would say as the norm, quote unquote norm. Again, not every practice is in every situation is normal. I've seen associates buy in 6 months and it be the most successful partnership that we've ever seen. So it really depends on how long it takes for the personalities to mesh, for the practice to see how well the associate produces. And it's got to be a minimum of 6 months, in my opinion, but usually about a year is a good period of time to get that understanding. And sometimes it takes even 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one other thing too that we're strong about, I believe, not just using the help of a broker to do this, but really sitting down with an expert that understands sales, transactions, the legal piece behind it, because one of the things that you and I talked about, selling a practice and real estate, that can get really, really messy. Just because if you're a young dentist watching this and you're like, oh, no, I'm just going to do this through a broker. I understand how to do this, blah, blah, blah. And then you buy a practice, but you're buying the practice and the real estate. Those often don't line up, right? Those can be completely different elements that go in different directions sometimes. Can you just speak about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that with the end of the year deals coming now, there's a heightened level of sensitivity wanting to push things really hard to close as soon as possible. And the reality is, when real estate is involved in a deal, real estate's always involved in a deal for the most part, whether it's a lease or whether it's the purchase of a building. But for the purposes of this conversation, I think we're kind of talking more about the purchase of a building. And in that sense, that can take some time, and that can often take longer than closing on the purchase of a practice, mainly because there's a lot of due diligence that needs to be done. There are more parties involved as a part of that due diligence, so you're depending on more people to do things in a period of time. If you're buying a building, you may need to get a survey. There are things that need to be done in a purchase of a building that can't always be done ASAP. And so what I'm seeing more and more now as these end of the year deals close is that the doctors are really eager to close the practice but they're not ready to close on the real estate. And so to sort of cut corners, what they'll do is they'll close the practice, they'll do an interim lease in the meantime, and then they will close on the building maybe later on down the road. Now, this is okay for some people, and this is a big mistake for other people. And so the circumstance and what the parties want is really important. If the parties are, let's say you have a seller who there's no way they're doing this deal unless they also sell the building, well, it's probably not the smartest thing for them to do an interim lease, because things can happen. And if the building sale doesn't close, even if they get a commitment from the buyer that would give them legal remedies against the buyer if they don't close it, the fact is, if they don't close it because their loan fell through or other circumstances, it didn't close. Whether they have legal remedies or not, it did not close. And now they got a problem because they've sold their practice and they've already transitioned the patients and the marketing has changed and all these different factors have changed, and they're stuck. So if a seller wants to be absolutely certain that they're going to sell the building with the practice, they should probably close them simultaneously. If the seller is sitting there saying, I'd love to close this building at the same time, but I'm perfectly okay with the lease, and if somehow this falls through, I'll lease this for a perpetual period of time, or maybe I'll increase the rent to incentivize them to want to buy this as soon as they can. If they don't buy it on time, well, then that might be okay in that situation. And then the roles are flipped. You know, you could have buyers who would never do a deal without buying the building, and you'd have buyers as well who are okay with not buying a building. So, but that's how I view the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And please hear this. This is not about an adversarial relationship where one benefits and the other doesn't. This truly has to be mutual on both sides for everybody to win. Actually, it's like a triple win, because when you get the buyer and seller, now you've got all the other people that are involved with it. Everybody knows this was the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the key.
Yeah. So, well, good. Now, there are dentists at this time of year, they feel pushed. So this comes up a lot, and you're a big fan of doing what's proper and not being pushed. What if I'm a young dentist, I'm watching this, and I'm like, David, I understand, but I'm really feeling pushed. What can I do?
Yeah, I think I see that more and more now, particularly as we get toward the end of the year when people want to make deals. And my recommendation is to stay the course and do things right. You surround yourself with a team and use that team to help you make sure that you're doing things properly. Now, some deals, time is of the essence, and you do have to move faster than you might in a different situation. Maybe it's February and you don't have people pushing as hard to close a deal as you do toward the end of the year. Well, then you might have a little more time. So I'm not saying to ignore the timeline of a deal. It's definitely important to take that into account and try to push as hard as you can. But my suggestion is that you don't compromise yourself by jumping into something because you're pushed to do something in a certain period of time if you are not ready. So you have to be able to look yourself in the mirror and say, you know, I have this deal on the table. I did everything that I could to get this done, except for jump into it without performing my due diligence. And I had to perform my due diligence because I couldn't look myself in the mirror if things didn't go right. And I knew that I didn't check into X or to Y or to Z, or I didn't have the legal documents reviewed, or whatever it might be. You don't want to be in that situation, because as we mentioned, it can set you back years. So to kind of summarize, I would recommend that stay the course, be aware of the timeline, and do everything you possibly can to meet the timeline, but by doing it properly within that timeline. And if you get to the end and the seller, let's say you're trying to buy a practice, you're a young doctor wanting to buy a practice, and let's say the seller pulls the deal from you, but you didn't have a chance to look into everything you wanted to look into. And if you know to yourself that you did everything you possibly could to look into all of those elements and you just didn't have the time, well, then it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't the right timing, in my opinion. You can roll the dice, you can do the deal, and maybe it works out, but it's not typically my recommendation.
Yeah, great, great advice, David. So any last thoughts that you have on either side when you're looking at independent contractor employment agreements or partnerships that you would add?
No, I think we covered a lot of it. And just kind of to summarize, I think it's important to consult your team and to make sure that if you're engaging in a contractorship or an employment dynamic, that you take the right route based upon what the law affords. And that if you do jump into a partnership, that you have either worked together before or you've gotten some sort of personality testing to make sure that you are mitigating. And Kirk said it so great before that you mitigate so you don't litigate. You're mitigating your chances of a disaster. Mm-hmm. And as far as getting pushed toward the end of the year deal or any deal, it doesn't have to be at the end of the year, just stay within yourself and know that you battled to do everything you possibly could to get yourself where you need to be. And if things fall into place, it's meant to be. And if things don't, then it probably was meant to be as well. But you have to know that you did everything you could. If you sit there and say, well, you know, I did sit on X, Y, or Z for a week and that was my fault. Well, then, you know, you're accountable for that, obviously. But if you did everything you could and the seller pulls a deal, if you're a buyer of a practice, young buyer of a practice, then it was just probably not meant to be. And there are other practices out there.
Great stuff, buddy. I appreciate your wisdom and your expertise and all of your advice all the time. So if people want to get a hold of you, because I know people are going to be watching this and they have questions, specific questions, how can we get a hold of you or where can we find out more about what you do?
Yeah, so the best way to get hold of me would be either via email, and my email address is david@cohenlawfirmpllc.com. So it's david@cohenlawfirm, P as in Paul, L as in Larry, C as in car.com. And I can also be reached by phone, 972-379-7513 is a great number. And if anyone has any questions, either way is great. I'll also check the Facebook page as well. Kirk does such a great job with these, and I'm always kind of looking around at others' interviews on there. So I'm always checking to see if people ask me questions on the ones that I do. And if they do, I'll be happy to email or to message you back.
Awesome, buddy. Well, we appreciate you so much. So stick around while we say goodbye to everybody else. But for those of you watching today or watching a little bit later on, thank you so much for watching the Best Practices Show. If you found this valuable, just do us a favor and hit the share button, because obviously we'd love to share this information with your friends and protect this great profession we love called dentistry. And until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show. You guys have a great rest of your day.